Hello and welcome. It's another Books of the Year podcast from your very good friends, in fact, your best friends at the Books of the Year podcast. Thanks for getting in touch. Booksoftheyear@yahoo.com.
Yes.
Celeste in Salford. Simon and Matt, I went on a trip to Venice recently and realised in the airport that I had not brought a book with me. I was only going for 3 nights, but still, this was an oversight. Browsing in the airport bookshop, I came across Drowning by T.J. Newman. I remembered you talking to her on the pod, but failed to heed your advice.
Yeah.
I began the book just as the plane took off. This is disastrous. About 5 minutes in, I had to shut it. And my eyes, it's incredibly descriptive and scary and heart racing, isn't it? But yes, the very worst book. I mean, look, the clue is in the cover, which has a plane heading vertically downwards. I thought I could handle it, says Celeste. But no, you were right. Don't read this when you're about to get on a plane. I did, however, read it in some delightful coffee shops and bars by the hotel pool, and luckily it hasn't put me off flying. Thank you for your great recommendations.
Yeah, excellent. We love that book. Yeah, but definitely don't read it on a plane. Paul in Leicester says, greetings all. I've just read a great memoir by Nikki Chapman. It's called So Tell Me What You Want, and is all about her career in the music industry from the late 80s through the 90s up until the mad hysteria of Pop Idol. What a fascinating life she had. She's worked with some amazing people, Spice Girls, Take That, Prince, Amy Winehouse, Annie Lennox. As a 45-year-old pop prince, this was a right old nostalgia trip for me, and I loved it. I recommend to anyone else who got into the music in the 90s and wants a little trip down memory lane. You probably know a lot of the same stories, Simon, but maybe have a slightly different perspective on them. In fact, didn't Nikki bring the Spice Girls into your studio at Radio 1 once? Is that right? Do you remember that?
That could well be the case. My main Spice Girls memory is that they all sat on me at the same time on a roadshow in Essex.
Yes. Well, that wasn't in Nikki's book, oddly. Anyway, I really, really enjoyed reading that and just wanted to let you know. Another completely different book that I've enjoyed recently, if I may be so indulgent, is The List of Suspicious Things by Jenny Godfrey. Thanks for the pod and keep up the great work, says Paul.
If you'd like to tell us what you're reading, good or bad, and just pass on some recommendation, or we can help you out, some kind of book quandary. I'm not quite sure what kind of wisdom we'd call on for that. Get in touch at any time, booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. We're at Books of the Year on Twitter. And if you're on Instagram and Threads, at Pick Any Page. Right, let's talk to today's very, very special guest, journalist and author Ben McIntyre. Yes, it's actually 2 years since Ben McIntyre was with us. I think we were talking about Colditz last time.
That's right.
You are a machine.
Yes, indeed.
His new book is The Siege, I'll give it its full title, The Remarkable Story of the Greatest SAS Hostage Drama. Matt, describe the cover, please.
Yes, and for those that don't know, this is about the Iranian embassy siege and the SAS storming that. So, not surprisingly, the front cover is dominated by the black and white picture of the SAS leaping from one balcony to another. It's basically an image that straight away, if you are of that age, you will automatically say, that's the Iranian embassy siege. The Sunday Times, number one best selling author Ben McIntyre at the top in black, The Siege in red, a master at setting the pulse racing, says the Daily Mail.
Now, so 2 years ago was Colditz. There's no way you've written this in 2 years. This must have been going a long time. The number of people that you've spoken to, the depth of the reporting in here, this feels like almost like a lifetime's work.
I've been working on this for about a decade. About 8 years ago, after I wrote SAS Rogue Heroes, my wartime book about the wartime SAS, I asked the SAS, what are the chances of getting access to the people who actually conducted the siege? What about talking to them? And they said, absolutely not. That is not going to happen. Partly because, you know, there are elements of the story that are still contemporary usage, that the SAS still has certain tactics that were involved in the siege. And also, you know, it's a time of when the SAS is anxious about what may or may not come out. So they didn't want to do it. So it's taken a long time to persuade them. But the breakthrough was when the Ministry of Defence gave formal authorization for those surviving members of the SAS who'd taken part to talk to me if they wanted to. They were under no obligation to do so. But almost all of them did. And for a lot of them, I think there was a sort of feeling on the part of the SAS bosses that these people are not going to be around forever, that their memories deserve to be properly recorded before it was too late. And in a way to counter the tendency, which, it, you know, still makes everyone smile, but there are a lot of people who claim to have been involved in the Iranian embassy siege who were nowhere near it. As one of the officers said to me at the beginning, he said, if everybody who claimed to have been involved in this assault had actually been on that balcony, it would have fallen off.
Yeah.
It's the equivalent of people who say they've seen the, say they saw the Velvet Underground in their very few gigs, you know, which probably about 30 people probably in total. So they trusted you and... They, because of your history, and they thought, if anyone is going to do this, it needs to be Ben McIntyre.
Well, I hope so. Yes, that does seem to have been the approach, and they've been incredibly helpful, really. They didn't have to be. They could have just shut me down completely. That sort of set me off on a trail of realising that there was so much material about this story that had never really come to light. This was 1980, so everybody was still writing everything down. I know that sounds like a slightly banal thing to say, but I found four unpublished accounts written by people who'd taken part in the siege. One of the hostages, the chief policeman who'd kept a diary, the coordinator, the Hector Gullen, the man who actually set out Operation Nimrod, the assault, and one of the hostages who'd kept a diary throughout. So there was a way of sort of accessing contemporary information and intelligence on what had actually happened, which was just irresistible, really.
OK, and I'm aware that this question could fill the entire your answer to it could fill the entire podcast, but I'm aware and I was saying to Matt earlier how little I knew about the I knew the images. I knew it was the Iranian embassy. I knew it was the SAS. I asked a good friend who really I thought would know all about this, because this is the kind of stuff he does. What was it about? He said, I don't know. So my question, Ben, is, without taking up the entire podcast, who carried out the siege? Who were they and what did they want?
9 out of 10 people.
And then Matt can ask a question. See you in half an hour.
9 out of 10 people, if you asked them what the Iranian embassy siege was about, they would say, well, it was Iran. It was just after the Iranian Revolution, so it must be about Islamic fundamentalism. That is completely wrong. It is not about Islamic fundamentalism. In fact, it's really a secular story, this one. Mm. The six gunmen who attacked that embassy on the early morning of the 30th of April, 1980, were Arab Iranians. They had, the Arabs, the minority Arabs in Iran, had supported the revolution, and they had expected that they would therefore get political rights. They were a very oppressed minority. Exactly the reverse happened. When the Ayatollah took control, he clamped down on the Arab protest movement, and hundreds of people were killed. That radicalized that movement. And these six gunmen were people bankrolled by Iraq, okay, because this was Saddam Hussein's way of getting back at the Iranians. In a way, the Iran-Iraq war, which would erupt a few months later, the first battle was going to be played out on the streets of London. These six gunmen wanted to stage a spectacular. They were going to attack the Iranian embassy, because the diplomats in that embassy were all representatives of the Ayatollah. The gunmen were attacking the Iranian regime. They were not representatives of the Iranian regime. And they'd chosen Britain because they felt that the British were on their side. They believed they would get a good hearing here. And their aims, to us, they seem madly naive, but they were quite simple. They were going to take hostages, Iranian hostages. They were going to force the Ayatollah to release Arab prisoners held in Tehran jails. They were then going to get their message out on the BBC. Then, they believed, they were going to be given a plane to fly home in, and they would release the hostages. That's how simple it was. It sounds mad to us today, but actually, in the context of 1970s terrorism, it was not an impossible set of demands.
Fans of your writing, which obviously me and Simon are count amongst them, have been used to your books, and used to your books spanning years, sometimes decades. And yet this one is basically, it's 6 days. 6 days between them getting into the embassy and the SAS rappelling down the side and storming in. And so, as Simon's already acknowledged, you know, most people's memory of this siege is going to be the SAS going in. What I thought was a great idea of yours was, I'm not going to tell this story just from one point of view. Right from the beginning, we are hearing what the SAS are doing. In fact, I think the SAS know that the embassy has been taken before, well, so maybe even before the rest of the army know. Certainly it appears before the Met know, because there's literally a guy from the SAS happened to be walking past. Just let's just talk about that to begin with.
Well, in fact, I think the SAS knew, well, they certainly knew before Margaret Thatcher knew. I mean, because a man called Dusty Gray, who happened to have left the SAS and joined the police, spotted what was happening in Prince's Gate and telephoned through to Hereford headquarters. So, in fact, the SAS were mobilised before the Home Office knew about it. They were on their way. They were trundling down the motorway. What I loved about, and thank you for alluding to that, Matt, and what I love about this story is it really, in a way, takes place in one room. I mean, there are 26 hostages. They're held in this room by six gunmen. And everything else feeds into that story, that what is going on inside there. So it's a wonderfully tense and gritty and detailed kind of story that's going on there. And because MI5 and the police had all inserted listening bugs into the building over time, it is possible to relay what was actually being said inside that room in, you know, exactly when it was happening. But you're absolutely right. So it's 6 days that boil down to Operation Nimrod, which is the thing we all remember, which takes 11 minutes. I mean, it's a very, very swift assault. And I love the way that the tension sort of builds inside this building. And you're right, there are lots of different aspects to it. It's not just about the police and the gunmen and the hostages. There are the press are involved. Negotiators are involved. The politicians are involved. Margaret Thatcher's investment in this is a real gamble. I mean, she is told there's going to be likelihood of 40% casualties. I think it would have gone the other way if this had not been the perceived success that it was. Margaret Thatcher's premiership, which was then only a year old, bear in mind, might have been a very different story. I think, you know, her whole approach to terrorism was framed by it. The story of the SAS was framed by it, because up until this point, the SAS was virtually unknown.
I'm just going to mention this. I'm sure Matt's going to mention it if I don't, but we're debating, being old BBC people, whether the television link from the snooker to the live coverage was actually very witty or enormously misplaced. You just want to tell us. So the viewing public, I know clearly we're jumping a bit all over here, but if you're watching this on the television, what did you see?
I was watching this. I was watching the snooker. I was one of the 14 million people, along with Matt and his dad, who were glued to Hurricane Higgins, Alex Hurricane Higgins and Cliff Thorburn. It was down to the last two frames. I mean, it was as exciting as snooker can get. And then suddenly it cut away. And the segue, which I happen to think is completely magnificent. Bear in mind, this was the Embassy snooker final. It was sponsored by the cigarette manufacturer. Everybody smoked throughout everything. So it was the Embassy final, and whispering Ted Lowe, the commentator, said, "And now we move from one embassy to another." And we the thing just cut across to this vision, which is on the front of the book, of these guys in balaclavas throwing what looked to me like rockets inside this building and then attacking it as it burst into flames. I mean, I was 14. I had never seen anything so exciting. And I think it's one of the reasons I became a kind of news reporter, in my first sort of part of my career. I mean, I really, and nobody actually had ever seen footage like this before. The technology was brand new. Yes, there had been dramatic moments on television, the assassination of Kennedy, the Jack Ruby shooting of the Harvey, and so on, and the moon landings. But those, we weren't watching those in real time. They weren't unexpected news items that sort of banged into your living room. And I think that's partly why this penetrated the national culture so completely, was because it was totally unexpected. Do you know, one of the things that makes me laugh is some of the few people who weren't watching this were the Cobra Committee in Whitehall. So the Emergency Cobra Committee had been assembled, run by Willie Whitelaw. They were being given reports, oral reports, of what was happening inside the embassy. But they didn't turn on the televisions around the room in the Cobra Committee, because it never occurred to them that there might be light, and they certainly weren't watching the snooker at that point. So they kind of missed it. They were the only people, and the terrorists inside the embassy, who were also not watching television, which was just as well, because if they had been, they would have seen the assault taking place, and the story might have been very different.
The fact that the Cobra Committee weren't watching what you, me and my dad, everyone else was watching, the very idea that the people right at the heart of this weren't watching is one of those facts that if you, if you've read Ben's stuff before, you're used to finding these unbelievable facts that if you were to put them into a fictional drama, you would say, well, obviously that would never happen. Obviously that would never happen. And I want to ask you about two others that occur in the book. One is that one of the hostages decides to pass the time, they're going to read Day of the Jackal. And you're like, it's a book about a terrorist, and you're going to be reading that during a siege? You put that into a drama, people are like, right, there's no way that a hostage is going to want to read something like that when they're going through this terror. And it turns out, yes, they did. The next thing I want to ask you about is Prince Andrew, but we'll come to that. Talk to us first about the very idea, because taking us inside that siege, clearly people just want to kill time.
They do. It's one of the key triggers in human behaviour that we often forget about is boredom. Boredom has a huge impact on the world, and boredom is something that a lot of people experience a lot of the time. Inside that embassy for 6 days, it became incredibly boring. I mean, terrifying and horrible and tense-making and all of that, but also dull. Nothing was really happening to them for long periods, and then it would in very short compass. And so there was a bit of a sort of scrap over who was going to read what. And the people were sort of... There was this copy of Day of the Jackal lying around, then fairly new book, and people were sort of vying for who was going to finish it, who was going to get it next. And there is another connection to that novel, because Carlos the Jackal, the Venezuelan terrorist, was sort of named after that book, because a copy of the book was said to have been found in his apartment after one of his appalling terrorist outrages. Well, actually, Carlos the Jackal has another link to this story. His attack with his terrorist group on the OPEC oil ministers, which had taken place a few years before the embassy siege, was one of the models on which these six gunmen based their assault. They were trying to do what Carlos the Jackal had already done, which was, in fact, a very, very successful terrorist attack.
And Prince Andrew wanted to get involved. Unbelievable. Tell us about that.
Well, I'm sure it'd have been very useful.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe this fact when it turned up. And it turns up in the diary written by the chief policeman in charge there. Prince Andrew, who was then a young helicopter pilot, learnt about the siege and decided he wanted to come along and have a look. And so message arrived from the palace saying the prince would like to attend, would like to sit in on the Zulu control, which was the main area that was organising it. And the wonderful policeman who was in charge, a man called John Dello, said, absolutely not on your life. I'm not having a sort of pampered prince wandering around here demanding to sort of see what happens. But Prince Andrew wouldn't give up. So a second message arrived saying, I just would like to have lunch in the back while you're all getting on with it. And again, he was told, absolutely, you can't. But you may turn up after it is all over, which he did, actually. I mean, he turned up at the site when it was done.
OK. Well, we can all draw various conclusions from that. So I just want to mention one of the other guys, because we've mentioned a few of the cast, and really we can only scratch the surface on this. The guy who was running it, Major Hector Gullen, there was a wonderful photograph of him in the Sunday Times. No, was it the Saturday Times? I think about what he's doing now. He just looks like a hippie. Long hair, shorts, scraggly, very much not the SAS guy. But I love the fact. So you talk about in there about his raw courage and so on. Unsung hero, unknown hero. But his men called him Hector the Corrector. Now, if you were to put, again, one of those things, if Day of the Jackal is one thing, Prince Andrew is another thing. If you were to put, why don't we get them to call him Hector the Corrector? I imagine they'd been watching Hector's House or something on television, grown up watching, listen with mother, watch with mother, that kind of thing. Tell us about Major Hector Gullen, Hector the Corrector, because he's like the linchpin man in all this.
He's absolutely vital. And indeed, without him, I don't think I would have been able to write this book. Hector Gullen was then a major. He was highly experienced. He was decorated in Dhofar. And he was head of B Squadron. He was the commander of B Squadron. Now, what very few people know is that the SAS since 1972 had a standing, what they call special projects team, ready to go in if there was a terrorist attack, if there was something that the civilian authorities could not cope with. Now, Hector and his squadron had been in Northern Ireland until very recently. They were very, very experienced in the training. What they'd never done was a real hostage situation. And Hector's job, well, actually, first of all, what very few people know is that within hours of this happening, the SAS were already installed in the next door building. They'd moved into number 15, which was the College of General Practitioners. They were ready to go at 10 minutes notice. Now, Hector's job was to try to frame up how they would carry out what was called a stronghold assault. And it's a very difficult thing to do, because if you've got armed men inside, they had submachine guns, they had explosives, they had grenades, and they were threatening to blow the whole building up. Attacking a defended building is very, very difficult. And it was Hector who drew up Operation Nimrod, and it's a highly sophisticated, very clever piece of military tactical engineering, for want of a better word. We have the two images, really. We have the front of the building where it's being windows are being blown out, and then occasionally you see the images of people abseiling down the back and then going in through the windows there. Actually, the assault on that building took place on five different fronts. It was a very complicated operation. There were soldiers going through the roof. There were others coming down the middle of the building. The centre was a void with a kind of glass atrium at the bottom. The attack was going to be set off, was going to be triggered by a large bomb lowered into the central shaft of the building, which was then going to blow out the atrium roof. And the idea was that this would then land on top of the lead gunman, who in theory should have been in the hall, because the field telephone that they'd put into the building had a measured cord on it. And in theory, if he was on the telephone, which they intended the attack to take place as he was negotiating with the police, he should have been standing in the hall. What they didn't know was that he'd actually looped the telephone wire up the banisters, and he was on the first floor. So in fact, as with all operations like this, the intelligence was not as good as it conceivably could have been. So the idea was that this would land on top of the lead gunman and give him, in Hector's words, a very close haircut, which I think is SAS for flatten him with 2.5 tons of glass and steel. I won't give away what happens, but like all military operations, I mean, it looked so slick from the outside. It looked so perfect, you know. It wasn't. I mean, this was highly complicated. Things went wrong. It did not go entirely according to plan.
Let's talk about the hostages themselves. Now, I'm sure you have. I'm not sure whether Simon has, but I've been on... you had to, when you were at the BBC, you had to go on these hostile environment courses.
I refused to go.
You refused to go. I had to go on a couple of them. And as part of it, basically, these ex-military guys get to chuck around a bunch of journalists for a few days. And one of them involves you being taken hostage. And you are taught by these ex-military guys that the way to get through a hostage drama like that is to be what they call the grey man. In other words, don't be the one that's trying to help the gunman, but also don't be the one that's particularly antagonistic. Be the grey one that they barely notice, and most likely you will get through the end of it unscathed. What they never mentioned was, when you're asleep, make sure that you snore very loudly, because you will then make sure that you are released very quickly. And so talk to us about one of those hostages who, by the way, I've had huge sympathies for, even though he was intensely irritating and his snoring sets him free.
Well, you're referring to an extraordinary man called Ali Gul Gahanzafar, who was a Pakistani tourist who just happened to be in the waiting room of the Iranian embassy when the assault took place. Like many of the people involved in this story, I mean, he wasn't a diplomat, he wasn't involved, he wasn't even a BBC journalist, as two of them were. He just happened to be passing, and a friend of his had gone in to do an interview with one of the embassy diplomats, and he'd just gone along for the ride, really. I mean, he just happened to be there. But he was a big man, Ali Gul, and he snored like a train. And it's one of the things that the hostages inside all recall and remember, that his snoring was driving everybody completely mad. At one point, this is quite a long way down the story, the gunmen decided, as an act of goodwill to the hostage negotiators, to the police, that they would release a hostage. And the man chosen to be released was Ali Gul. And I think, I mean, Sim Harris, who's another of the hostages with us still, I'm delighted to say, he's of the strong opinion that Gul was allowed to go because he was just keeping everybody awake the entire time. But it's funny. I mean, this book, I really wanted to explore what ordinary people do in some ways, in circumstances that they can't control. It's one thing if you're trained like the SAS or the police and so on, but many of the people in this story had absolutely no inkling or any, didn't have any kind of hostage or hostile training. They had no idea what was coming to them. And we'd all like to think that we'd behave in certain ways in those circumstances, that we would find reserves of some sort that would get us through. But people behave in very different ways. And you're absolutely right. Some people hunkered down and just tried not to be seen. By the end, there were 22 people still left inside, tried not to be seen. Others, I think incredibly bravely decided that the best thing they could do would be to be interlocutors between the hostage negotiators and the gunmen. There was a certain amount of sympathy emerging among the hostages for their captors. Now, this is familiar. We know this happens. Stockholm syndrome is the sort of catch-all phrase that is used to describe it, rather a simple shorthand for something that is much more complicated than that. And there's a thing called Lima syndrome, which is the flip side, which is when the hostage takers develop a certain affinity for the people that they are holding hostage. And those are complicated relationships, and the unspooling of those is absolutely fascinating. So you've got a whole sort of cast of people who do behave in fascinatingly different ways. I mean, one of the kind of unsung extraordinary people, really, was Trevor Locke, who was the policeman on the door of the embassy. Trevor is a wonderful man, but he himself would say that he was not your Sweeney type of policeman. He was a Dixon of Dock Green.
You do describe him later on as 15 and a half stone of prime barking policeman.
Well, he was a big fella, Trevor, and still is. And he's just a most wonderful man. And he told me, he said, I joined the police to help old ladies cross the road. He said, I didn't want to do this. And yet, two extraordinary things. The first one was that when he was bundled into the embassy, he had a gun on his hip. He was carrying a revolver. And a bit like Chekhov's gun, that gun stays on his hip throughout this assault. The gunmen never find it. And Trevor realised very early on that because he had the gun on him, he couldn't go to the loo because the gunmen would accompany the male hostages to the toilet when they were going. And he realised that if he unbuttoned his coat, that they would see the gun. So he made a calculation. He thought, I can't eat or drink anything. So food was coming in. Drinks were coming in. This was part of the negotiation. And Trevor refused to touch any of it. It's the most, it sounds ridiculous, but it's the most heroic case of self-induced constipation in history that I've ever come across. And that gun was not discovered. And it plays a very, very important role in the sort of denouement. But Trevor realised that he had to kind of set an example for the other hostages. And so almost instinctively, he sat himself in the largest Queen Anne chair in the hostage room, like a sort of king. And he never took his uniform off. He never took his cap off because he realised he had to kind of symbolise a kind of British law and order will sustain. That's a kind of strange, unexpected, accidental kind of heroism. It's not a kind of gung-ho SAS type kick the doors down. But nonetheless, that requires a real sense of kind of resolve and reserve, I think.
At the end of the book, you talk about remembered material. And how some of the people who say they were there remember, or maybe they were there, I forget, remember a sniper firing, which you say definitely didn't happen. But can you just say, and you also say some of the people that you interviewed might feel a little bit shortchanged by the book. Can you explain a little bit about who was reliable and who wasn't?
Well, this is how memory works, isn't it? Is that we think our memories are truth. But actually, our memories, I think, are the sort of narratives that we tell ourselves to accommodate the past, to kind of get to grips with it. And the one you mentioned, the sort of sniper story, is one that is deeply embedded in SAS stories. I mean, people who were actually there told me that that had happened, and they believed it. It wasn't that they were lying or making it
up. And what were they saying had happened?
They were saying that one of the snipers who were based in Hyde Park had spotted one of the gunmen at the window and had fired a single round and killed him. It didn't happen. It could not have happened. I've been through all the forensics reports. None of the five gunmen who died, none of them died that way. But nonetheless, this is a story that people believe. And we know, don't we, that if you have a sort of collective experience, often you borrow other people's memories. So if somebody is very emphatic about what happened at a certain time, it becomes part of our own story. So one of the challenges of this book was trying to tease apart what was and what was not true, what was verifiable. And because I was able to speak, for example, to pretty much all the SAS people involved, after a while, I began to work out which bits were sort of mythologized and which bits were not. And then I had a lot of written detail as well.
You've mentioned already the impact that this assault had on, and the siege itself had on Margaret Thatcher and her standing in the country. Let's talk about the impact it had on the SAS, because up until this point, very few people had heard or were aware of what the SAS were. as a result of this assault on the embassy, we now know that whenever there is any kind of international incident, the first headline is always send in the SAS. Tell us about the impact it had, because there's a telling quote from someone in the SAS who said this was the worst thing that could have happened to the SAS because of the amount of publicity that suddenly flooded their way as a result of these live pictures.
I mean, the effect was very dramatic, Matt. I mean, overnight, the SAS became a household name. The number of applications to join the SAS rocketed. I mean, guys, boys were turning up at recruitment centres, being asked to be given, you know, asking to be given a balaclava helmet and a machine gun so they could go off and attack embassies on their own. I mean, it became sort of ludicrous, actually. And all the macho television programmes that we see today, all the Who Dares Win stuff, that is a direct cultural legacy of the Iranian embassy siege. But they were unknown, virtually unknown before this happened. Yes, they were operative in Northern Ireland. There was some controversy surrounding the regiment already. But really, 99% of people had never heard of them. So it was transformative in that way. One of the things that happened was that the SAS, other countries began asking to borrow the SAS for hostage training and indeed for active hostage operations. It became a kind of calling card for the British military. It was also a sort of post-imperial demonstration to lots of people that we were still a force to be reckoned with. You know, when the chips are down, the Brits can do it. But there is a view within the SAS that what it did was it deprived them of the capacity to operate in the shadows, which they'd been doing for three decades by that point, very successfully. You know, and so the covert nature of what the SAS is required to do, what special forces do, became very, very difficult. And I think many people would agree with this. The SAS is still struggling between the demands on the one hand of celebrity and fame and notoriety, and on the other hand of the need to maintain secrecy and clandestine operations. And the person you're alluding to is Michael Rose, who went on to become General Sir Michael Rose, who was the commander of 22 SAS at the time when this assault happened. He ordered the attack. He believes it's the worst thing that ever happened to the regiment. He believes it thrust them into the limelight in a way that fundamentally changed the capacity of special forces to do what they have to do.
I just noticed you're wearing a very military-style shirt yourself.
I've just realised I've kind of dressed in almost entirely in khaki.
You're dressed in khaki and your shirt has like a paratrooper's logo.
Yeah, I'm a bit worried about that. I think that subliminally, this is an Italian Air Force shirt. The Italian Air Force make very, very nice shirts. They're very good for running away in. But
they oh, dear.
That's very good. Yeah. I think you can... You can have that for your next book, I think. So even though this was 1980, Ben, it sounds as though we're still living, in terms of the stuff that we don't think about, thankfully, most of the year, that we're still living with the implications of what happened in 1980 in the way that we are policed or in the way that we are protected.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think... In multiple ways, this was both the end of an era of terrorism and the beginning of a new one. After 1980, oddly, there were no future major hostage incidents in this country. Before this, attacking embassies around the world had been a kind of terrorism stock in trade.
And of course, the American hostages were still being held. And Jimmy Carter, just before this, had that disastrous rescue mission where everything had gone wrong.
That's right. I mean, the hostage situation in Tehran hung over this story. I mean, Thatcher and her advisers were acutely aware that if it went wrong, as the one you've just alluded to, Operation Eagle Claw, which damaged Carter's presidency forever. I mean, he never really recovered his credibility after that. The stakes were incredibly high. But yes, we still live with this story. We live with the implications of this story. So on the one hand, this really is, as I said before, this is the kind of first battle of the Iran-Iraq war. This whole thing is sponsored by Saddam Hussein as a way of getting at Iran. That war erupts a few months later. No Iran-Iraq war, no Gulf war, no Gulf war, no Afghanistan, no Afghanistan, no 9/11. There is a continuum of history that works here. And as I said at the beginning, look, I don't want to make these gunmen seem like they were credible or justified in what they did. But their families had been destroyed by the Ayatollah. That, you know, they had lost brothers and mothers and homes. And as we know from current politics, the best way to make a man into a killer is to kill the thing that he loves. And so while these are not, these are men of violence, they set out to do a very violent thing. They were prepared to kill and be killed. They nonetheless have their human stories. And if we other everybody, if we treat history as if it's a black and white morality tale in which there are goodies and baddies, we will never get to grips with the way human beings behave. Because, I mean, that is a profound point. There's a huge tendency at the moment to think that the past somehow offers simple moral lessons. And this is a good example, because I, like many other people, thought this was a quite simple story when I first set out to look at it. Actually, it's a really complicated story. It's a complicated story about human emotions and personalities and the way characters evolve. It's not some sort of shoot-em-up, daring-do story of brave British soldiers and evil terrorists. It's much, much more interesting than that. And if we can get to the bottom of that stuff, perhaps we can stop looking at the world as if it's good and evil.
Tell us about the TV adaptation, which is going to be coming our way.
Well, very excitingly, Will Smith, who is the screenwriter and showrunner for Slow Horses, is writing the 6-part adaptation of the book, and I know he will do it absolutely wonderfully. And it's produced by Patrick Spence, who is the producer behind Mr. Bates and the Post Office. They're a really good team, and I'm hopeful, and I think they will do this, that again, because this story has been so, the legend is so simplified in our collective memory, I think they are going to tell the story from all the different points of view. It's not going to just be a sort of simple story of derring do. It'll be told from the point of view of the hostages and the hostage negotiators and the police and the press and the public and the politicians. So I hope we'll get a rounded dramatization of what really happened. Six episodes, 6 days. It all goes down to 11 minutes at the end.
Fantastic. And if this book took 10 years to write, or the best part of 10 years, you must know what you're working on next.
I do. I'm deep in the next one, which is a Cold War spy story that nobody has ever heard of before. And it's one of those ones, it's one of the rare ones. I mean, I've said this probably on your show before, but espionage doesn't always make a huge amount of difference. I mean, you know, it oils the wheels of diplomacy. We know what they're doing, they know what we're doing. It's sort of a zero-sum game. Occasionally, it really changes the world that we live in. And this story, I don't want to oversell it because I haven't written it yet, but it's, you know, if this story had turned out differently, we would be living in a very different world.
That's terrible. I'm already looking forward to your next book.
He's just booked his next appearance with that.
Ah, excellent.
Well, Ben McIntyre's book is The Siege, The Remarkable Story of the Greatest SAS Hostage Drama. It is fantastic. We've scratched the surface, really, in the last 40 minutes. Ben will be with you in another few days with a Q&A. But Ben, until then, thank you very much indeed.
Been a huge pleasure, guys. Thank you.